I love scotch. 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 Scotch.
Yep. Have another whiskey.
If you'd like to speak to me in person, press 1. If you'd like to order drugs, press hash.
I had a gentleman in the crowd that was like, tell me how to drink Glenfiddich. And I was like, I will not do that.
Yep.
You drink Glenfiddich how you want to drink Glenfiddich.
Wear a cowboy hat in Los Angeles and look at the amount of looks you get.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. This is the most flamboyant city on earth. You wear a cowboy hat, people look at you like you are like an alien.
The Beatles came on and they picked me up on his shoulder. George Harrison is as close to me as that wall now. I went, all right, George, all right. And he went, cough. And that was the closest I ever came to the Beatles.
Have a whiskey while we...
Yeah, let's do it again.
Yeah.
Cheers, long.
Cheers. Welcome back to United States of Dramerica, and I'm very excited to have what can only be described as a very real Scotsman on the podcast. he's a singing legend, huge football fan, and a resident of my favourite place on earth. Welcome to the podcast, a man who lives in Las Vegas, Big Jimmy Denning.
How are you, mate? Thanks for having me.
I'm all right, thank you. How are you?
I'm very well, pal. I've got a large glass of scotch. This is the best kind of interview to do, where, you know, the ones where you can drink and no one shouts at you for them. So this is perfect.
So sometimes the scotch doesn't get opened until halfway through, but you'd warmed up for this. You're very professional. You've already got your scotch
straight in.
Yeah.
I mean, it's about 8:30 p.m. here, so I've had to hold back to make sure. Normally it's 5 o'clock, so be thankful that I'm starting late.
So let's do the who's drinking what. So what's at your end of the Zoom in the glass?
So I have an Alexander Murray, 16-year-old. I'm going to put this there like that. It is it's just one of my favourites. And as I was saying to you before the show, it comes from a distillery just outside of Arbalur in the Highlands. And it's about 30 minutes from the town of Nairn, which is my real surname. And so I thought it'd be kind of poignant to have a scotch that was bottled and distilled and casked and all that kind of stuff from somewhere that I'm sort of associated with. Because the problem is, coming from Glasgow, the distilleries are in and around Glasgow, I'd be sitting here with a pint of, you know, Tennent Super or a bottle of Iron Brew or something like that. So I thought I'd be ever as sophisticated as possible.
Oh, I appreciate that. Obviously, Alexander Murray is a drink that should be well known to our listeners, because Steve, who founded the company, was on here a few episodes ago, and I've drunk it on a few occasions. For my whiskey, I was saying to you before, I always try and pair the whiskey with the guest. I was trying to come up with something clever based on where you're from. But again, I've got the same problem you have, which is if I've got to do a Glasgow whiskey, it's Auchentoshan or Iron Brew. And I've done Auchentoshan a few times. So I was thinking, well, what can I do? And I'm like, well, you're a Rangers fan, so I'm just going to go for the colour of Rangers. So for the second time, when I had a Rangers fan on before I did this as well, we've got Johnny Walker Blue Label, which of course is a lovely dram.
Very nice.
We always get into this whole, like, all the snobs who say blended whiskey isn't as good as single malt, but actually I'm very much of the... If somebody spent a lot of time putting together different blends in order to create something special from single malts, then why wouldn't it be good?
See, I think you're absolutely right. I think if it tastes good, it's absolutely fine. But I will tell you a story about mixing. When you talk about mixing, are you familiar with Matt Goss? You know, the lead singer of Bross, the 80s sort of boy band.
Yeah, I've met him a couple of times.
Yeah,
he's in Vegas, guy, isn't he? So
yeah, so he lives out here. Matt's a friend. And he knows that we all love whiskey. And he told me one day, he says, what's your favorite whiskey? I says, I have too many, really. And he says, I love Macallan. And I said, oh, that's lovely. And he said, I've got a beautiful, it's like 21, 22-year Macallan, like really expensive. He said, what I do is I have a decanter and I mix it with Johnny Blue. Well, at that point, our friendship took a very weird turn. I'm saying, you did what? And he says, well, I mix it with Johnny Blue. It just tastes absolutely fantastic. I'm going, well, I didn't know Satan was in a boy band. Jesus wept. What are you doing? And he absolutely, like, he lives by it. He won't drink either one of them separately. He'll just mix the two of them. And I'm like, you're mad. Like, he wouldn't last 10 minutes where I come from. If my grandfather heard that, he'd probably smack him over the head with the decanter.
That is extraordinary. So,
yeah, you know, I mean, why would you do that?
Yeah, that is now become my least favorite member of that boy band. But
can you name the others?
Well, so in the weird, one of the ridiculous things about living in LA is the random people you meet. So I remember I met Matt at one of the events at the British Consul General's residence, because obviously I was a diplomat and we used to invite famous British people to things, and he came. It was the same night I met Audley Harrison, who I know you're a boxing fan. So
There you go.
It was a weird night. But anyway, I met Audley and I met Matt Goss. And then about 2 weeks later, I was in my local Ralph's and I saw Luke in the supermarket.
All right, yeah. Luke's a cool guy. He's a nice guy.
But anyway, more importantly, that's a very weird thing I've never heard before. I have heard of this thing. I've never done it. And some people love it. This, what I call infinity bottle. Have you heard of this principle? Where you when you've nearly finished a bottle of something, you pour in some other stuff and it never ends, and you just add the dregs of different whiskies in a bottle that never ends, and you just end up mixing different things in. And it just sounds like such a terrible idea.
Yeah, and we wonder why the world's going mad. You know, if it's not that, it's Love Island and programs like that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a whiskey snob. You know, I drink banana flavour bourbon sometimes if I have to, but I would never mix. Like, I'll put ginger ale in a lower end whiskey. Like, whiskey and ginger is a drink I don't mind. So I put it in Johnny Walker, well, maybe black, but not double black. But I would never mix single. I mean, I'll drink blended whiskey, but I wouldn't self-blend two good whiskies together. That would be a ridiculous thing.
It's totally mad. I don't know what he's off his head, bless him. Doesn't know what he's talking about.
Well, anyway.
But he's a Cockney, so what would he know about whiskey?
I was going to say, I was thinking, theoretically, I could have invited him onto the podcast, but I'm not sure that would be appropriate now, knowing what he does.
let me phone him and ask him. Yeah. I'll say the first thing that's coming up is the fact, is that disgusting decanter of it's just, what a terrible idea.
So Johnny Walker Blue and a good Macallan blended together.
I'm talking a very good Macallan. I can't remember which one it is, but it's like 20 odd years old. It's, you know, it's expensive. It's nice. And he mixes the two together. I'm like, you're off your head.
I mean, obviously, given the world you guys operate in, people give people whiskey. So I hope somebody who gave him that as a thank you for something. Because that's the sort of, like, somebody could have given him that Macallan for some something that he did, or a super fan did or something. And then if they found out that then he pissed it away by pouring it into something else, what a massively offensive thing to do.
I genuinely hope they're watching and listening to this podcast right now, because I've just outed him. And he deserves it, and I'll tell him next time I see him.
Absolutely. We can't spend the whole podcast talking about an Englishman and what he doesn't know what to do with whiskey. So let's move on to, let's talk about you. So let me get this right. You are the only Scots man to have a regular. Tell me how you told me.
Someone. I have the title of the only Scottish headliner in Las Vegas, at current, and I'm only the second one after Sheena Easton, and I'm the only man, apparently, because Rod Stewart doesn't count because he was born in England. So even though I speak with a Northern English twang, I left Scotland when I was like 9 years old, so I sound like an Englishman, but I am a 100% Scottish Scotsman. So so it was someone from, I can't remember if it was the Daily Record or the Sunday Mail, one of the newspapers was interviewing me when the show opened, and they said, and they mentioned something like this, we've actually looked back and we don't think there's been anyone else. And since I've been here, I've never really cared about stuff like that. But yeah, apparently it's true. So I'm very proud to be flying the flag for my little country over here in this crazy Sin City, you know.
So Rod Stewart, who sounds more Scottish than you, doesn't count.
No, he doesn't. He sounds like a Cockney. Come on. And he's a Celtic fan, so that doesn't even count at all. He's almost Irish.
So, Vegas.
Yeah.
I love Vegas. You obviously don't mind it, given you live there.
Yeah.
When you first got to Vegas, as a, I don't know if you were ever an innocent Scotsman, but as a relatively innocent young man going to Vegas, tell me what it was like seeing Vegas for the first time.
To be honest with you, I'd been to Vegas a lot as a kid because I got brought up with I boxed as a kid all the way through my teens. And a lot of my family were involved in the fight game. So we used to come to Vegas a lot to see like the old Mike Tyson fights and Evander Holyfield and Riddick Bowe and all those kind of guys. So I'd seen Vegas in the 90s. And then I hadn't ever been back until we played here a one-off show in, I think it was 2014. And I came back and I'm telling all the boys, I said, you're going to love Vegas. It's so cheap. And, you know, you can drink for cheap and the buffets are cheap. It's fantastic. And of course, little did I know that over the 15 or 16 years that I've been missing, Vegas has become a very different place and it's just doubled, tripled in size. So it wasn't so much of a surprise to me when we moved over. We only had 6 weeks to pack and to do everything to move. You know, we've got a lot to thank our wives and families for, because we were away on tour in Asia. We get a phone call from the people at Caesars Entertainment and they said, we like what you do. Would you like to have a residency in Las Vegas? And it was literally that easy. And we went, yeah, that would be lovely. And we were in the Philippines and we had to fly back and we had 6 weeks to pack everything up, sort the visas out. And yeah, we landed. And then what happened was you get this thing in Vegas. It's so competitive that I believe there's like 100 pre-COVID, I think there was 185 shows running at the same time in the evenings. So, and obviously only a limited amount of people coming into the city. So people said, you won't last 3 months. Enjoy yourselves, guys. So, you know, we've been very successful everywhere else in the world, but we thought, well, this is Vegas. We're not going to compete with, you know, all these big names, all these big established shows. So we just decided for the first 3 months to do the show. And then after the show, go out and drink excessively all night and party and live it up and fall into bed at 7 a.m. and do the whole thing again. It was as rock and roll as you could possibly do it. And then you get into the fourth month and you're still selling tickets and you're still being well received. You start to get into more of a rhythm of how you have to live your life, because I think we'd have all keeled over with the amount of booze and steaks and this ridiculous life that we had. So then you settled into it, and and that's almost 5 years later. We're still here, and we still haven't been home yet. You know, I mean, I've been home for 24 hours in 5 years since the point where we moved. We flew back in to do a show in London, and we landed, went straight to the gig. We did the gig, came back to the airport, flew back to America. So it probably was only about 15 hours I was in the UK for. And just enough time to pick up some decent chocolate at the airport. But funny enough, my wife has never been home. When she moved over with me in end of 2016, she's not been home. Because of visas and COVID and, you know, blah, 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 blah. So, yeah, it's been a crazy ride.
Because that's the thing about Vegas that I always find fascinating. I love Vegas. For the regular listeners to the podcast will know I talk about it a lot. But, you know, I always find it fascinating when I arrive there and I'm in an Uber and I talk to the taxi drivers and they're, you know, people who actually live there. Like, we never go to the strip. You know, we'll go there to work, but we never... Mm-hmm. We'll never go there because it, you know, it will be an all-consuming lifestyle. I think visitors don't realize that, like, if you live there, if you're just going to a restaurant, you're not taking your wife to the Wynn for dinner. You know, you'll just go to the place in your local area.
When
you first got there, were you sort of actually doing the real showbiz Vegas thing? So, like, you'd wake up in the morning, you'd be like, right, let's go to the casino, let's go to the pool, all that.
To be honest with you, we didn't wake up in the morning. We used to wake up about 4 o'clock in the afternoon and we would go to the show. I'd go to the show. We'd do the show. Afterwards, we especially when we opened, we had lots of friends and people from kind of around the world that were in town. And we've worked in America a lot. So we used to have quite a lot of guests come in. So all of a sudden our green room after the show was always full. So you'd have a few drinks and all of a sudden it's midnight. And then, you know, you think, well, let's go out for dinner. You go out for dinner somewhere, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. Hey, let's go to the Bellagio for cocktails. Yay, fantastic. And all of a sudden it's 5, 6 o'clock in the morning and you're having pancakes at Denny's and you're thinking, Jesus, I've got to get home. So you went home, sleep all day, do the same thing. Literally for 3 months we did that. And like I said, nearly died doing it. Had a great time, but nearly died. But yeah, I mean, but to be honest with you, what people always say, what's the best bit about living in Vegas? And I always say the outskirts of Vegas, the suburbs. It's so unbelievably beautiful. This is a beautiful place. And, you know, from where my house is, I'm 10 minutes away from the Red Rock Mountains. You can go running, you can go walking. It's just like, it's paradise. It's insanely beautiful. And you would never know that you are literally 25 minutes from the Strip in Las Vegas. You know, we've got a beautiful ski resort up in Mount Charleston, which is 50 minutes away. You know, so the surrounding areas is actually the best bit for me. The bit on the Strip is, like you said, you couldn't spend all of your time down there if you weren't on vacation. Because, yeah, you, first of all, you'd be broke. You'd probably have some form of liver disease. And you know, and you'd be 500 pounds. And I'm working my way up to that anyway, so...
It's interesting because I've met a few people in Vegas who I've stayed in touch with, and all of those people I met at a blackjack table or in a bar, yeah, of some kind. You're, yeah, the only person I've met in Vegas where the place we met is quite hard. I need you to describe it, but I'll start by saying the things about it I found fascinating were it was less than $2 for a beer.
Yeah.
It was, you know, there wasn't a neon sign that you could see within probably half a mile, maybe like a dodgy liquor store around the corner where some of the letters were missing from the sign. But other than that, I don't think any neon. Also, the night we were there, there was a very large Mexican wedding taking place right That's next right. door to where I was meeting you. But can you explain to people, like, you know, I mean, I'll be back in Vegas actually next week. And I hope that you and I can go out somewhere else. I didn't mind that place, but I almost feel like in order for us to have a real relationship, we have to have been to real Vegas. But explain that place to the layman.
So, yeah. So, as you said at the beginning, I'm a fan of Glasgow Rangers Soccer Club, Football Club, wherever you're listening to from. And, We have a club there, the Las Vegas Loyal, which is the Rangers supporters club of all the Scottish guys that follow the club in Vegas. And the club where we put on our games is like a very, very, very old Masonic lodge, which was built, I believe, in like 1920 or something like this. The building itself, 1920, maybe 1930. And what's happened? At the time, Vegas was still just one street, you know, like obviously the one or two casinos popping up in the 40s and stuff. So this place has been there for a long time. And what's happened is in East, Northeast Vegas is sort of what you would class as the ghetto. So in the middle of this ghetto area, you have this lodge, and the guys and girls there have always been really good to us. And we go in there and watch the game. So when Orange County came to play the Las Vegas Lights at the stadium, which is just around the corner, we arranged the two meetings, and obviously that's where we met. But it's like an old working men's club back home in the UK. I don't know what the equivalent is here in the States, but, you know, like I said, it's a buck a beer. It's got a certain kind of charm to it. Let's say if the bathrooms are operational, then that's a bonus. You know, it's the kind of place where the snooker table isn't level. There's random dogs running around. there's a karaoke machine with all these songs from 1960 backwards on it. It is quite a unique place, the Eagles, but at the moment that's where we go and watch the games, and that's where we actually have been watching the games over the years. We just go in there. But a very, very bizarre. I'm totally not Vegas. Go on.
Of the guests I've had on this podcast, I've talked about, you know, obviously I share a whiskey with them either in real life, which is what we used to do pre-COVID, or now we're sharing whiskeys over Zoom. But often, yeah, I've met these people before and we've drunk whiskeys together. And, you know, I've told stories of drinking Balvenie 50 upstairs in Soho House and drinking in, yeah, distilleries. But the first whiskey we shared together was, I think it was a Glenlivet 12, which weirdly, it probably cost I don't know, and you bought the round very kindly. I think it was probably like $4 or $5 for a glass, which is unheard of.
That's why I bought the round.
Indeed. And I think we had it in like, I was actually a bit disappointed they weren't red solo cups. They were just plain plastic cups. But, you know, I try not to drink scotch out of plastic cups as, you know, one of the things I try in life. But what happens at that place?
Yeah, it's a very unique experience going in there. It really is. It's just because of where it is. It's the most bizarre thing. You would never know that you're in Las Vegas.
But so that's the thing, because obviously you've done, because of the nature of the work that you've done there, and obviously Vegas is obviously a very extreme place. But if you're in showbiz anywhere, you get a bit of love. But if you're obviously in showbiz in Vegas, I imagine you have been to some of the most spectacular bars and restaurants up and down the strip and all that. So the fact that you've got sort of, you've probably done full both ends of the spectrum, dive bar to the fanciest bar.
To be very honest with you, I'm a you know, working class lad. So I prefer places like that with the boys where we can have a buck of beer and have a crack and, you know, I never take myself too seriously, but yeah, it's nice at certain points. You know, being the sort of—I'd say status. It sounds such a wanky thing to say, but being what you do in Vegas and stuff, you always get invited to a party here, and it's an open bar, and oh, fantastic, great. I remember there's two occasions. Once we went and did a show for the guy who was the president of Caesars at the time, a guy called Mark Frisora, and he was this CEO, top man in Caesars worldwide. And there's a suite at the top of Caesar's Palace that not even Elton John and Celine Dion get into. It's a very private suite, and they only give it to billionaire gamblers.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, this thing is, it's like 7 bedrooms. There's a cinema in it. There's a swimming pool on the roof, like private. It's amazing. So he had an event for a load of very famous people and a lot of influential people, and I'm talking governors of states in America, politicians, kings, queens, this kind of stuff. And he'd asked us to come and sing a couple of songs. They had a whole stage area set up. So it was us and I think another act from one of the Caesars properties. And we went up, and he's a super cool guy. And he said, listen, just stick around. And he says, just enjoy this room. I was like, this is unbelievable. Like, it was the most affluence I've ever seen. And we've done good gigs in Oman and Bahrain. I've seen affluence before. You know, I've seen the sheiks with the million-dollar yachts and everything. But this was insane. And, of course, they're passing around Cristal champagne and this kind of thing. And it blows your mind. It absolutely blows your mind. And then in the distance, I saw, I'm going to get this wrong, but one of the guys I was with, who's a real expert on scotch, because I'm really not an expert on scotch. I'm an expert drinking it, but no major expert on telling you about it. And he pulled out this bottle, and it was something like $10,000 a bottle for this scotch. And it gets brought over from Scotland. And it's only served in certain bars, like 5 bars in America, the affluent place in New York and LA, blah, 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 blah. And I said, can I try that? And of course they go, of course, sir, no problems at all. And like a shot of it is like $1,000. But of course it was an open bar. So I'm going, so I took the first one. I went, that is, Jesus. I said, that is absolutely beautiful. And then the next, you know, back of my throat started burning. And I was like, oh my God, what's that? You know? So I ended up coughing, and as I coughed, I threw up everywhere. So I don't know what the brand was, but in the most expensive suite in Vegas, I believe it's one of the most expensive suites in the world, they served me a $1,000 shot of this whiskey that was supposed to be very nice. It turned out not to be very nice at all. And because I hadn't drunk or anything. I wasn't drunk or anything like this. It just caught me in the back. I thought, Jesus Christ, what's that? I just went, bah! In the middle of, you know, the governor of Nebraska's there, and then there's someone else who's a diplomat from this country. You could well have been there, sir. And so that's kind of the greatest experience that I've ever had with that kind of affluence. Other than we played,
sorry, we got asked by Jimmy, if I can. And so was that the end of your residence at a Caesars property, or did they let you play the next day?
Fortunately not, because see, when you throw up, in a very, very affluent environment. When you throw up in a very affluent environment, there's always a cleaner very close by. So literally a plate lands on the table, it gets moved away. So the same thing happened. Something happened like that. Someone came straight over. I'm so sorry, sir. Clean, 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 gone. So I think I actually got away with it. Other than the guys that I are in the band with me that found it very funny. I don't think anyone else other than you now and your listeners know that that ever happened.
Obviously, given that you're between gigs at the moment, now's probably not the best time to tell people this story. But still,
I don't mind.
What I love about Vegas is whatever you're doing and however much money you've got and whatever VIP line you think you're in, there's always another one. Like, I remember when I didn't have any money, like, you know, the first time I went to Vegas, I went to a nightclub and queued up, and there's like a line for VIPs, and then there's like another line for Uber VIPs, and then there's obviously like a side door as well. But wherever you get to, you think you've reached sort of peak Vegas, and then you find out that there's something else going on. But I think my closest I've got to peak, I didn't throw up, although it might have been funny if I had, but it's become a funnier story now because of what's happened in the news recently. But my most Vegas experience, when I was a diplomat, I remember bringing a government minister to Vegas for, I think it was CES, the world's largest trade show, the big tech show. So we had a government minister there, and I was looking after him as we do. And we went out, we got invited. There's all sorts of parties to get thrown during CES. And we ended up at... So I ended up accompanying Matt Hancock, or I think we now call him now disgraced Matt Hancock, to a private Gwen Stefani concert somewhere at the back of Aria, I think it was. And it was just like, at the time, it's just, you know, you're just doing your job. And it's all a bit weird because, you know, being a diplomat in Vegas, half the things there you're not allowed to do because it might cost you even with immunity.
Doesn't it sound like a Jackie Collins book, A Diplomat in Vegas?
But yeah,
that's bizarre.
It was a memorable evening. So apart from your being, I don't want to overdo. I think you are very down to earth, and that's what I very much like about you. But I also like down to earth people's funny stories. So apart from the throwing up in the suite, give me your most Vegas experience. Like, who were you with and in what place? Because you must have a very Vegas story.
I'm trying to think off the top of my head that there's sort of so many. I remember never really, because I'm not one of these people that thinks, you know, I'll be very proud to say I've done amazing things. We've played stadiums all over the world. I played the Albert Hall. You know, I used to be in the top 100 people that have ever performed at the London Palladium. I was on that list for a short period of time. The most performances, you know, done there, because I was in a couple of musicals that was at the Palladium. Some amazing things. But I've also done some shite, yeah, as we all have. You know, we've all done that gig. And, you know, so I don't really ever absorb sometimes the situation that I'm in. And I think it's a good thing because, you know, when you step out for NBC to sing the Star Spangled Banner at the T-Mobile for the Golden Knights in the hockey, and you think, right, well, there's not only 20,000 people in the stadium, there's probably 2 or 3 million watching on the TV, and we're a load of British guys singing the American national anthem. So if you let it get to you, all of a sudden the nerves get to you, because, you know, no one likes to screw up the US national anthem ever, but don't ever do it live on television if you're British, you know. So I've never really allowed myself to get to really understand where I was. And maybe one of the nights that I remember, it was about 3 or 4 weeks after the shootings we had here in Vegas, the October 1st shootings in 2017. And Caesars Entertainment put together a gala to raise money for the police and the paramedics and the local hospitals, everyone that helps, to put money into the benevolent fund and blah, 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 blah. So they organized this huge benefit dinner. It was massive. 2 or 3,000 people in one of their conference rooms. And they said, would you come and open it? And we came and did 3 or 4 songs to open the thing. And of course, you're like, this is truly amazing. And we had to start our show late because it would have clashed. So I believe 8 o'clock performance, we would have We had to tell everyone it's 8:30 by the time. But of course, you get to this thing at 5 o'clock and everybody's speech overruns. You've got the commissioner of the police. Then you've got the mayor of Las Vegas. Then you've got Steve Sisolak, the governor. And then you've got the president of this. And they all want to speak and they all want to be heard. And this thing's ticking along. And we got taken into a room prior to going on. And in the room, the meal was put together by all of the celebrity chefs that have restaurants within Caesar's sort of empire. So the starter was Bobby Flay. The dessert was Guy Fieri. Gordon Ramsay did the main. Giada, she did like the salad or something or other. We were in there. It was us. Wayne Newton was in there with us. That's when you kind of know, when you meet Wayne Newton for the very first time, who, by the way, is an absolute star. And so we're all running late. So when we've got past chatting with everybody, and we get to Wayne Newton and we say, Wayne, do you have a show tonight? And he says, yeah, I've got a show in 20 minutes. But he says, you guys are on before me. And I says, well, they're going to have to sort something out. And that's the king in Vegas. That man's a god in this town. And I never forget being taken round. We're already late. My mother, who is a comedian, my dad's a comedian as well, were actually coming to see my show at Harrah's that night. So I had to phone my mother. This is a billion-dollar operation. I had to phone my mother and say, Mum, we're not going to make it by 8:30. We're probably going to be 9:15, and people are going to be pissed off. We couldn't get a hold of people. Our company manager was trying to get a hold of people, so we don't know what to do. People are going to be annoyed. So I phoned my mother and said, Mum, I'm going to phone someone. They're going to give you a microphone. Go on and give them 10 minutes and explain the situation and who you are and just go on and do it. So my mum made her Las Vegas debut that night. Mm-hmm. So she held the fort for us, explaining the situation, and she did it beautifully, by the way. And when we came off the stage, there was like a limo waiting for us to rush us across the street to Harrah's. And we finished our thing. It was very nice. And we jumped in the limo. And as we were running out of the limo, we couldn't get out because Wayne Newton's limo had broken down. Would you believe? The King of Vegas's limo had broken down to take him to wherever he was doing his show. And he's now stood in full dinner suit with his assistant with him. And he's very cool. He doesn't shout and scream. He's a really cool guy. And I'll never forget this. We're rolling down the window going, here, Wayne, what a lift. And he's like, cheers, boys. So he then jumps into the limo. So now there's us and Wayne Newton, who are both late for our performances, and this limo driver that has no fucking clue what's going on. And we're going, put your foot down. We've got people to entertain. And we go darting around the street. And we ended up lobbing Wayne out at Bally's. They whizzed round to Harrah's. And we ran on stage. My mother was still hosting. She said, ladies and gentlemen, it's now time for showtime. Please welcome the tenors of rock. And the fucking band kicks off. And we've all got dry mouths because we've been running around so much. But it was that night. I was sitting having a drink with my dad. And I told that story to my dad. And he went, there you go, son. That's making it in Vegas, isn't it? I was like, I don't think many other people have got stories like that, that we actually gave away even the lift in the limo.
That is amazing. That's what I wanted. I didn't want some sort of like, yeah, I was sitting in a suite with Elton John at the Bellagio. That's what I wanted you to tell me about Wayne Newton's broken down limo and your mum filling in. That's Scottish Vegas.
Amen to that. Absolutely is, mate. Absolutely.
Amazing. Not sure what we do next now. No, so let's talk. One thing we actually haven't even, I think you mentioned Tenors of Rock for the first time. We hadn't actually mentioned that is your group.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Actually, I don't want to do the sort of coronavirus thing as much as what, obviously, there's been no performances. There's been no headline acts in Vegas for a year and so. Obviously, I was in Vegas the other day. I think the only two people I saw in Vegas were me and our croupier at the hotel. Like, no one's... I mean, Vegas is not the great... After, I think, the mayor of Las Vegas was talking about using Vegas as a Petri dish in, like, May last year. Not a great
look. She likes a drink, put it that way.
You can tell. But... Obviously, Vegas has had a tough-ish time because it's the conference city. and there's no conferences. What's it looking like on the strip at the moment in terms of performances are beginning to kick off and people presumably are getting their whatever you call hot girl summer, but for everybody is presumably happening. Everyone's just out there spending their money and living their life.
I mean, to be honest with you, Vegas is back. We're not going to be back because prior to Vegas, we'd spent a year at Planet Hollywood and we were sort of umming and ahhing as to whether we wanted to stay there. There's lots of reasons for that, which I'm not going to go into right now. But so we were approached about two or three other places that would like to have the show and have us. So that all kind of happened just around the COVID time. So we didn't know. We have a very good relationship with the people at Caesars and we were going to stay there. And so now COVID closed everything down. So now we've had all this time to figure out the next move and stuff. But to be honest with you, as far as us starting back is probably looking at, I would say, the end of September, October, which is good for us because that's when shows do well. The shows don't tend to do very well over the summer because it's a much younger crowd that don't buy tickets for entertainment as such. They just want to get drunk and sit, listen to a DJ around a pool. But a lot of the shows now are Cirque du Soleil starting to have performances back. Certain a few other shows are starting to trickle back, but a lot of them will start in September because it's a better time to start. So they could start right now, but it's really not very profitable. You know, we're specifically kind of waiting for them to open up the borders to Europe and Britain in particular, because that's a big source of ticket sales for us, is people that kind of know us from back home. So. So we're just waiting for that. But as far as like Vegas, it doesn't look any different now. It's rocking and rolling. The hotel rooms are packed out. They're still overcharging for everything. as far as, it was a strange time during the COVID thing, because unlike a lot of other states, Nevada relies on that strip. Mm. You know, the entire state, like, there's no other industry there. So it's not like you have a booming technology industry or a booming fuel industry or anything like that. There's literally nothing. So when COVID closed the strip down, it literally hammers the state a lot more than a lot of other states. So that was hard. I know lots of friends that had businesses go under, and but I would say the last 3 months, it's rocking and rolling. I sort of hope this Delta stuff that goes on right now doesn't kind of come in and ruin that, because I think you've now got it to a point where people feel comfortable and people are coming back and enjoying themselves, spending their money, and hopefully buying tickets to a tennis of rock show soon.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to turn the podcast serious, because particularly with quite a fun guest who's from a family of comedians, but I have to ask, I guess, a serious question. So I guess to put it bluntly, you nearly died.
I don't know how close to death I was. But I was terribly sick. So we finished on the let me get this right. We finished on the Friday night, which I believe was the 14th, 15th of March. And we got the phone call and they said, shows, we're off for 3 weeks while this virus comes through. I've still got the email. It's hilarious.
Yeah.
And of course that went on. Now, we've been consistently working for about 8 years. You know, constantly on the road in an airport, doing a gig on a tour, like really no time for a holiday or anything like this. And, you know, it's quite taxing on the voice. It's quite taxing on the, you know, the brain. And, you know, me and the boys are very close, but, you know, being together all the time, any band will tell you, being separated is a good thing. So we were all exhausted. So when they said, you're going to have 3 weeks off, we were like, oh, this is fabulous. So me and the wife were looking at flights to Hawaii, you know, being as ignorant as hell, thinking this is going to be great. We can finally go on vacation. And then, of course, it got a bit serious. But the week, literally a week after the show got cancelled, I just started feeling sick. And I was like, I feel like I've got the flu and stuff. And she said, do you think you've got this COVID thing? I said, maybe. I don't get sick. I don't have any pre-existing conditions. I'm relatively fit, relatively healthy. He says, drinking scotch. But scotch is good for the blood. That's as good for the circulation, as my grandfather always told me.
Absolutely.
I literally out of nowhere, I just felt bad. And I was 2 or 3 days and I thought, I've got this COVID thing. They won't give me a test. They said you're positive, but they said you're absolutely fine. And then I actually got a little bit better and I thought, oh, this is, that's all right. I can, you know, kick this, no problems at all. And then it hits you. So you get like this little rise, you know, you feel a bit bad. Then it gets a lot better. And then all of a sudden it just went bananas. And then the next thing you know, I'm needing oxygen. And then the next thing you know, I can't breathe. And they're putting me through all sorts of stuff and in and out of the hospital. And oh, it was horrendous. So I was, to be honest, I was sick for about, I want to say 2.5 months. Jesus. And then after 2.5 months, you then have to try and get fit again, because being a singer, you kind of rely on your lungs. And I was, you know, I was like, I couldn't get out of bed and walk to my bathroom, my own suite, without going and having to stop for 10 minutes because I was so tired. So at the time, you think your show's coming back up in the next 3 or 4 weeks, I'm thinking, I've got to get some energy back. I've got to get some stuff back. But that probably took another couple of months to get to, you know, that up and running. But yeah, I was in a really, really bad way. And, you know, whenever I was in the hospital, they sent me, you know, I was in for a period and they sent me away and then I got worse again. And it was horrible because a lot of my good friends, who's the same age as me, unfortunately, went through exactly the same thing as me. And then it got 10 times worse. And unfortunately, we lost him. But he, yes, it kind of dawns on you that, you know, regardless what people will say, it's something that can, if you get it, I understand most people don't get that badly affected by it, but I'm a big lad. I'm 300 pounds. I'm 6'4". I'm active with no problems. And I couldn't lift a glass for, I would say, 6-7 weeks. I couldn't hold a glass in my hand. It would just fall out of my hand. That's how much you were ruined. And I had oxygen machines and stuff, even moved into the house, sleeping with oxygen. Oh, it was horrendous. So yeah, I'm just glad to out the other side of it. I'm one of the lucky ones, fortunately. You know, I put it down to drinking a lot of this over the years.
I was going
to
say, you don't have any problems lifting a glass nowadays.
But not at all. And if I did, I'd just get a straw.
I guess it's not quite an ethical question, but I remember we had someone on the podcast who ran a bar last year, and he nearly lost his business. And I asked him, like, you know, you want your business to do well, but if you're encouraging people to come back and they get sick, you know, how do you deal with that? So I guess from your point of view, like, obviously I know a lot more people are vaccinated nowadays and so on, but you know, you've been through it, so you know how bad it could be. But for your not so much, I guess, partly for your livelihood, but also just because I know you like all performers, you like to perform. You know, you want to see Vegas full in September and you want to be playing in front of crowds. But is there a part of you that's like, well, you know, I want people to come back, but I don't want people to be flying transatlantically and coming to stay in Vegas if it's not safe for them to do so? Like, how do you square that circle?
I mean, I would say, if, you know, I think the horrible thing about the whole thing is the politics that has been played with this whole thing is outrageous by the governments themselves, and also by the newspaper and news channels and stuff that spin it their own particular way, dependent on, you know, let's say which presidential candidate you're a fan of. What I would say is, if the facts are that we've been told are true, then I would rather be closed for 2 years and limit the amount of people that would get hurt, you know. But on the other side of it, I saw, you know, you want and need to go back to work. And but that has to be done safely. I don't, you know, I'm not one of these people that believes that it's Bill Gates putting chips into us, or I don't believe it's made up. But I also have doctor friends of mine that tell me that the wearing a mask is a completely pointless thing. And I have doctors very, very close to me back home and here in the US. They said the masks are not designed to stop like pathogens or to stop viruses or whatever things. They're just designed to stop you from coughing blood on someone or them coughing blood on you, kind of thing. And you know, things that come out of your mouth. So they said, I don't quite understand the need for that. But to be honest with you, without getting political, I want everyone to be happy. I want everyone to be safe. And if the people that are much more educated in the situation than I am say, guys, we need to close down for 3 months while we get this under control, then I would hope, I'm not naive enough to think that it wouldn't be a political decision, because of course it's always a political decision, it's always a financial decision. But if it was, if someone told me categorically this needs to happen, then you go, okay, you know, it's unfortunate, but you step aside. You know, I'd rather do that for my fellow man than go back to work, you know. But there's so much misinformation that goes on with this. And that. I'm sure there's people listening to this that think, oh, he's a bloody fool. And some people are applauding. Do you know what I mean? Mm. See, you're never going to win. And you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with being nice to your fellow human being and going, I'm not wearing this mask for me. When the mask thing first came out, I never thought I'm wearing the mask to protect myself, because I thought I'm big and strong. You know, I don't need to worry about it. I'm doing it to protect the person next to me in the supermarket that might have asthma or might have a lung missing, or, you know, that's kind of, and I'm thinking that's not a bad way to be as a human being. Let's just try and help each other out. It's not people flapping about wearing a mask. I mean, come on, get a grip of yourself. You know, if it's necessary, it's necessary. If it's not, then do you know what? If it stops someone else getting sick, then I'm fine with it. It doesn't bother me in the slightest.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think, you know, it's tricky. I'm definitely not from the plandemic school of thought, but there's a lot of theatre to this that doesn't mm-hmm. make any sense. I mean, going back to football, there were 60,000 people at Wembley for the Euro final, plus obviously the incredibly well-behaved English fans who stormed in without tickets that pushed up a bit. And then your beloved Rangers played Arsenal on Saturday, and they only let 2,000 people in because they're worried about COVID. Now, what the hell's all that about? You know, that's where people get upset. Because then if it doesn't make sense, it becomes very hard to stick to the
rule. I think that, exactly. And I'm all for having, if it's safe, having stadiums back with sports fans in it. And like Vegas did the same thing. There was 2,000 people allowed into some of the ice hockey games, and then as it moved on, they upped it, and they're going, that's absolutely fine. Well, they did it here, at least when you could open venues and you could open theatres. So it was the same rule for everybody. You know, my sister's a very well-known sort of West End leading lady back home, and you know, she loves her football, and she's a very proud English lass, and she says, I love the fact that we're allowed to have fans in the stadium. But she said, why can't I open my show? Because the government, the Arts Council say, well, you can't do this because people have to be tested and people have to do this. And we're just doing it to be safe. And then you turn on, you know, you turn on the TV and you're seeing 60,000 people shouting and screaming and drinking in a stadium. And so I understand probably more so back home why everyone's so kind of annoyed with the one rule for one and one for another, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So, We've talked about two controversial topics on this podcast, COVID and Matt Goss's whiskey selection.
Ridiculous,
We've actually reached the end now, unfortunately. This feels like, I've always thought that maybe I'll get to an episode where we're going to have to do a double episode because there's so much to talk about. But we've reached the sort of the length that our listeners like. So I'm going to actually rather sadly move us on to the final question, I'm looking forward to this from you, which is, if you could drink any whiskey with anyone, dead or alive, who would it be, what would it be, and where would it be?
Oh, that puts me on the spot. Okay. To be honest, like I said, I'm no real whiskey connoisseur. I know what I like. And funny enough, I really enjoy a Johnny Blue, and I actually very much enjoy this this Alexander Murray that we're having right now. So, a nice, expensive Macallan would be my drink. I would say it's funny because people always say, you know, they always go, do you know, I'd love to sit down with Nelson Mandela, and I'm thinking, fuck off, like seriously, come on, like. First of all, like, he would want to drink a whiskey anyway. But I'm kind of going, as great as Nelson Mandela is, I'm going, what the fuck do I have in common with Nelson Mandela? I admire him immensely. But you go, I there's a few people that I think I would love to, but more and more living in America, this is going to surprise a lot of people. I would love to have a drink with Garth Brooks.
Wow. Wait, sorry, did you say Garth Crooks?
I would love to have a drink with Garth Brooks, not Garth Crooks, because he's another one. He's another one. He wouldn't have a fucking whiskey. But the reason is, I went to see Garth Brooks in 1994. Now, I'm not the biggest country fan. I love all the country, Johnny Cash and Glen Campbell and people like that. And I don't really like country music nowadays. But I went to see him in 1994, and it was one of the most epic gigs I've ever seen as in my life, still to this day. And I kind of just watched what he did, and I was a young performer. You know, I was a young kid that maybe I had aspirations to be a footballer, but after that, you kind of watch him, and everything that he did, you learned immensely from little tweaks, little things that he did that would probably no one else would really notice. But as a musician, as a singer and stuff, you go, oh my God, that's really clever. And he has a very good way of making every single person in the arena think that they're his best friend. And that's a really rare quality. There's not many people can do that. So I'd love to, I nearly met him a couple of years ago, and I'd just love to sit and just talk. I don't need to talk about his accomplishments. I'm not going to blow smoke up his ass, but I would love to talk about the way he kind of crafted and made himself into one of the biggest stars of all time type of thing. And I think he's a working class guy himself. I think we'd probably have a lot of fun. So there's many people. Tony Bennett would be up there for me. Comedian Bill Hicks would be another. But yeah, right now I'd actually say if I could meet anybody and have a drink with them, it would be Garth Brooks. You probably wouldn't have said that. You know, most people in my would have said, oh, I'd love to meet Mike Tyson. I've met Mike Tyson. He's great. He's a nice fellow as well. But it's like Pele. I want to meet Pele. Or I want to meet, Richard Branson or something like this. No, I think Garth Brooks would be, I think we'd have an absolute hoot. And why not, let's do it on his ranch somewhere in Oklahoma.
Amazing.
You know?
That's a
I'll bring him, yeah.
It's, you know, we're 80-something episodes into this podcast, and we've had everything from, like, our mutual friend Ross King, talked about his dad. We've had quite a few family member as the sort of the person. We've had Jesus twice. We've had Winston Churchill about three times. You know, like some of the obvious ones.
But, yeah, exactly, because they're obvious. I'd love to sit down and have a drink drink a whiskey with Jesus. I'm like, get a grip of yourself. It would be red wine if it's anything, you know.
Well, I mean, it might start with red wine. He might turn it into whiskey. I mean, who knows? Mate, that's a great answer. So brilliant. So look, Big Jimmy Denning, or James Nairn, as he could be known.
That's my real name. Don't tell the tax man.
Former Blackpool YTS player, Rangers fan, singer, close friend and limo companion of Wayne Newton. Thank you very much for being part of the podcast.
Thanks, mate. Really enjoyed it. Thanks so much.
I love scotch. Scotch. Scotch.
And don't forget to not just follow us on Twitter and Instagram at US of Dramerica, but also ask us questions and comment and say nice things.
And please don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. And if the mood takes you, you can leave us a review, as feedback is always welcome.
And drink whiskey. Slán tír.